readers, welcome back to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and I know where most of you will be this Sunday evening. Like me, you'll be tuning into the Academy Awards. Whether you love the movies or just love to see who's wearing what or who's with whom, it's a fun evening. Hooray for Hollywood! Now, a few weeks back, we devoted the show to books that this year's crop of Oscar hopefuls were drawn from. This week, we're going to look at notable new titles about actors, producers, movie tycoons, the people who've won their share of those coveted gold statuettes. Yep, it's the Titles from Tinseltown show. Curtain up, here we go.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. M-A-G-I-C-B-U-Z.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
Charming, engaging, and surprisingly forthright, Michael Caine gives us his insider's view of Hollywood and the story of his brilliant second act in The Elephant to Hollywood. When he was in his late 50s, Michael Caine believed his glamorous rags-to-riches Hollywood career had come to an end. The scripts being sent his way were horrendous. When one script really disappointed him, he called the producer to complain about the part. And the producer said, "No, we don't want you for the lover, we want you for the father." Salvation came in the unlikely form of his old friend Jack Nicholson, who convinced him to give acting one more shot. What followed was not only an incredible personal transformation, but also one of the most radical comebacks in film history. Learning to accept his new role on camera and in his own life, Caine went on to win his second Oscar for Cider House Rules in 1999. Good night, you princes of Maine, you kings of New England. Oscar number one was for Hannah and Her Sisters in 1986. In his new book, he shares the story of his life, his humble upbringing in London's poverty-stricken Elephant and Castle, his military service, marriage and family life, plus lively adventures with friends, legendary meetings with fellow stars, forays as a restaurateur, and hilarious off-screen encounters from his glittering five-decade career. Caine himself narrates and brings his gift for storytelling and his insider's view to a tale that is funny, warm, and deeply honest.
It was a fabulous group to spend a holiday with. I don't ski, but I have really worked hard at developing my après-ski skills. And that is what Aspen is all about. As we sat around enjoying the sunshine, gossiping about old times and eating fabulous food with this great group of people, I felt pretty happy with my lot. Everyone there had been a part of my life since I first got to Hollywood. Although, in fact, I'd met Sean in London back in the late 1950s at what was then called a bottle party. If someone was giving a party in those days and couldn't quite afford it, the invitation would be, bring a bottle and a bird. I was broke so that I couldn't afford to bring a bottle, so I brought two birds, and they were very beautiful girls. I walked into this party and there was Sean, who seemed enormous, compared with the rest of us weedy-type actors, and he saw me with those two girls, and I became his instant new best friend. That period back in the 1950s was a tough time for me, perhaps the toughest I've ever known, and I was living hand-to-mouth through much of it, owing small sums of money to people all over London and often having to cross the road to avoid creditors. Of course, what I couldn't have foreseen was that years later, Shirley MacLaine would choose me to play opposite her in Gambit and give me a welcome to L.A. party and inward walk Sidney Poitier. and that Sydney would become my instant new best friend. Aspen with old friends was followed by a period back in Hollywood. I felt on top of the world. Things could only get better. I was completely oblivious to the downturn in store for me. My wife Shakira and I had bought a small house with a fantastic view, not on a Beverly Hill, but in the more modest district of Truesdale. It was a holiday home, really. Our main base was back in England. But we wanted to be close to our dear friend, the great agent Swifty Lazar, whose wife Mary was very sick. Apart from Mary's illness, there was no sign of impending doom. Nothing seemed to have changed. Our old friends were all in town. As with our New Year's at Aspen, the dinner we had one night at Chasen's restaurant in Hollywood with Frank and Barbara Sinatra, Greg and Veronique Peck, George and Jolene Schlatter, seemed to reflect all that was good in our lives. It was a great Hollywood evening, full of in-jokes, including a prime one from George that seemed to sum up perfectly the relationship between actors and their agent. George is one of the great TV producers, the man who discovered Goldie Hawn in his fantastic show Rowan and Martin's Laughing, and every bit as funny as the shows he's produced. I've been lucky. My agents have always been close friends. But the relationship between stars and agents is usually quite distant socially. The joke goes, an actor gets a telephone call to say that his house has been burnt down and his wife raped. The actor rushes home and a police officer meets him outside and tells him that it is his agent who has come to the house, burnt it down and raped his wife. The actor's jaw drops and he turns to the policeman and says, completely astonished, "My agent came to my house." In fact, that dinner at Chasen's and the one the following week at Barbara Streisand's, all Art Deco and sensational shaker furniture, were to be the last high for quite some time. Looking back to this period, I can see now what I couldn't see then. The storm clouds, as they say, were gathering. A movie I had made the previous year, Noises Off, had come out and gone just as quickly. I wasn't too bothered. Everyone has a flop movie now and then, I thought. But it was another little sign. I took no notice. I had become part of Hollywood history. Completely out of the blue, Robert Mitchum, the great 1950s movie star, asked me to present his Lifetime Achievement Award at the Golden Globes. I loved Bob Mitchum and was honoured that he should ask me, but I didn't know him, and I'd never worked with him, and I was curious. "Did you pick me because I have heavy eyelids like you?" I asked him. And he said, "Yes. You're the only one, you know. People are always talking about my eyelids, and then I saw you in Alfie, and I thought to myself, this guy's got heavy eyelids too. They're not as heavy as mine, of course, but they're quite heavy. It's all to do with the eyelids." A charming story, and Bob was a charming guy. But I began to wonder if it was really because everyone else had turned him down.
From the moment Judi Dench appeared as a teenager in York Mystery Plays, it was clear that acting would be her career. And in Furthermore, Judi shares her story. Judi trained at London's Central School of Speech and Drama, but it was her performance in her 20s as Juliet in Franco Zeffirelli's memorable Old Vic production that turned her into a star. She first became a household name via television, thanks initially to a sitcom, A Fine Romance, in which she played with actor Michael Williams, who she wed in 1971. She has since starred in other sitcoms as well as plays and classic serials, including the popular Middlemarch. In the cinema, her films have ranged from Ladies in Lavender opposite Maggie Smith, through Notes on a Scandal with Cate Blanchett, to Shakespeare in Love, her Oscar-winning portrayal of Queen Elizabeth in 1998. But it is as M in six James Bond films, starting with GoldenEye in 1995, that gained her worldwide recognition. If you're in the mood for a great who's who in the theater world, this one's for you. Samantha Bond narrates.
Once they went to a party with Daddy as Shakespeare and Mummy as Elizabeth I, and she made the most incredible dress for the Queen. They were also in a film about Dick Turpin's ride to York, and I still have the picture of the two of them on the stairs at home. A man called Wilson, who taught me to ride, was in the film with them, and he left us a box of costumes from it, with various bodices and skirts. Mummy could whip up anything. And after I'd seen the Laurence Olivier film of Henry V, I longed to go to a fancy dress party as the Princess of France. So she made me the most beautiful dress, with cotton wool all round the sleeve, marked like ermine. I made the headdress that I had seen Rennie Asherson wearing, with a piece of netting round my head and a ruler through the top. It looked absolutely terrific. It never crossed my mind that one day I would play that part on stage. Over the years, there were all sorts of things that had just got put in the ottoman, which we were always digging through. I just thought that all families got dressed up like that. When the settlement players did Christopher Fry's The Firstborn, I played Tuzerette, the Pharaoh's daughter. Christopher became a great friend years later, and I rather regret that that is the only time I've ever acted in one of his plays. When I was at Clifton Preparatory School, we did a nativity play, and I was told I was to play a fairy, which I was quite cross about, because I knew the nativity story did not involve fairies. I also played a snail once, and Alice in Alice in Wonderland. My brothers, Peter and Geoffrey, who were quite a bit older than me, appeared in school productions at St. Peter's in York, which is one of the oldest schools in the country. In Shaw's Caesar and Cleopatra, Peter played Caesar and Geoff was Cleopatra. I saw Geoff as Kate in The Taming of the Shrew, and Cassius in Julius Caesar, and Peter as Duncan in Macbeth. I thought it was very racy to spin round on the piano stool at home and say, "What bloody man is that?" That was all I remembered of the play, but I did say that rather a lot. Because of the age gap between us, I was, of course, sent to bed much earlier than the boys, and I remember so well going to bed and hearing them playing cricket in the garden and hearing all that life going on outside. I simply couldn't bear it, and it's still like that. I don't like missing anything. Even today, I hate to be in bed and hear people talking downstairs, because I'm far too nosy. I have to know what they are on about. Our house was in an area called York Without, because it was outside the city walls. We had a long, straight strip of garden with a few apple trees. We couldn't grow very much, apart from some lovely lilies of the valley and a few roses, and we used to rake the pears off the tree next door. At the end of the garden was an old barn, and owls used to live in there. When the boys had friends round playing cricket, they were always knocking the ball over into Miss Lazenby's garden, and she would never give the ball back, however much we asked for it. One day, Geoff found a rat in the barn, and they did it all up and gave it to me to take round and push through her door. Daddy heard about it and told us all off. My first school, Miss Meeby's, was just up the road from my brother's school, St. Peter's, so when I finished for the day, I used to go and sit on the wall and watch the boys playing games, waiting for my mother to come and take us home. When I went to the Mount School in the city, there were no such things as day girls, so I had to be a boarder all the time. But I didn't mind that at all, really. We were allowed home at weekends for just a day, but not to sleep. When games were cancelled, we had to go on what was called a wet walk, all sorts of different walks that we had to do. So I used to go out of school, ring up home, and they would come and fetch us. We would have a huge tea, then Mummy would water us in the garden with a watering can, drop us at a corner near school, and we trudged back soaked to the skin. I don't think we were ever caught out. The first play I saw at the Mount was Julius Caesar, with lots of big girls in bigger togas. I thought that it was not at all a good play to do, and it is the one Roman play I have fought shy of ever since. But it was there that I first played Titania in A Midsummer Night's Dream, a role I returned to with the RSC in 1962 for Peter Hall, and again in 2010, at his request, at the Kingston Rose Theatre. The teacher who had the most influence on me had been known as Joy Harvey when she'd worked with John Gielgud, but at school she was called Mrs. MacDonald. Her marriage had broken up, but after I left, she wrote me the most lovely letter, saying that she was standing on York Station when suddenly her husband had appeared and they had got together again years after their breakup.
Musical comedy films are a favorite of mine, and perhaps yours too. Remember the 60s film Gypsy, starring Natalie Wood and Rosalind Russell as Mama Rose, the stage mother to beat all stage mothers? Karen Abbott, the New York Times best-selling author, has just published American Rose, A Nation Laid Bare, The Life and Times of Gypsy Rose Lee. It's a look not only at the evolution of the star, but the empire-building Minsky brothers of New York's Lower East Side, plus Jazz Age and Depression-era gangsters, politicians, literati, and entertainers. Well, phew, talk about dysfunctional families. Read the book and you'll see that the movie was loosely, and I mean very loosely, based on fact. Mama Rose was a con artist, a thief, and a murderer times three. In the early years, she crisscrossed the country on a city-to-city vaudeville circuit with her daughters, Dainty June and Gypsy, then known as Louise. Stocky and boyish in those days, Louise developed a keen mind and a sly sense of humor, armor against psychological abuse heaped upon her by Mama Rose. The book chronicles Gypsy's rise to stardom, the great sacrifices it took to get there, and strongly hints at very dark family secrets. The author actually interviewed Gypsy's sister, June Havoc, 40 years after Gypsy's death, when June was 92. She also interviewed Gypsy's son, Eric, born after a brief affair with Otto Preminger. Welcome, Karen.
Thanks for having me.
I really enjoyed learning everything I did from the book. After all these years, why did Gypsy's story intrigue you?
Well, it started with my grandmother, actually. She's 92 years old, and so just a few years younger than Gypsy would have been. Gypsy would have turned 100 years old on January 8th. And so my grandmother always told me stories about growing up during the Great Depression, and she once relayed a tale about a cousin who claims to have seen Gypsy Rose Lee perform in 1935. And the cousin said that Gypsy took a full 15 minutes to peel off a single glove, and that she was so damn good at it, he gladly would have given her 15 more. So this story got me thinking, you know, who was Gypsy Rose Lee? Who could possibly take the simple act of peeling off a glove and make it so riveting that somebody might be compelled to watch this for a full half hour?
I actually watched the video on YouTube, and there wasn't a lot of skin at the end of the six-minute YouTube.
Yeah, that was one of her later acts. That was called The Psychology of a Stripteaser. And, of course, it was this really brilliant self-satirical spoof on stripping and all of the rigorous education she had to go through in order to take her clothes off. And the joke of that whole strip was it was called the Inside Out Strip. And she would come out in this great billowing Victorian costume with the hoop skirt and the crinoline, and slowly but surely, you know, her garter would appear, a glove would peel down, her bra would come flying out, the stockings would go down, but she remained pretty much as clothed at the end of the act as she did at the beginning because the Victorian garments were still on her. But in the beginning, you know, when she first started out, she was as naked as everybody else, you know, of course, there was that one year that she didn't really like to talk about, where she was performing in some really seedy underworld clubs before she became famous at Minsky's in New York City.
And can you share some of the what went on in that year? Because in the book, it hinted at dark secrets, but it really didn't go there.
Well, I told as much as there was to tell. June and her son both said there was a year she didn't like to talk about. So by definition, she didn't really talk about it much. But what they said that she was forced to do things against her will and intimated that one of those things was prostitution. And she was desperate. This is right after Vaudeville died and right before she became discovered in New York City. And, you know, she's eating dog food to survive and living hand to mouth day to day with her mother. And I think, you know, got caught up in some pretty unsavory situations and met some characters and really just did anything she could to survive.
I see. How did you uncover all the facts that you did about Gypsy and her sister and Mama Rose?
I spent 3 years researching the book, and the research included connecting with Gypsy's sister, the late actress June Havoc. I was the last person to interview her. She just passed last March, and her son, I spoke with him quite a bit, and also immersed myself for countless hours in Gypsy's archives at the New York Public Library. Some fascinating correspondence in there, never-before-published letters between Gypsy and her mother, which really shows the intensely dramatic and really crazy back-and-forth emotional bond between the two of them. And, of course, one of my favorite pieces of correspondence of all time, that telegram from Eleanor Roosevelt to Gypsy Rose Lee that said, may your bare ass always be shining. I thought anyone who got a letter from the First Lady that said that was definitely worth looking into.
Yeah. Well, Mama Rose
was an ogre. What did you think of Gypsy's relationship with her sister? Am I wrong to think that she could have helped June more when June was starving and doing the marathon dancing, just anything to get by?
Well, you know, their relationship was really complicated, and I think that was part of Mama Rose's design. You know, from a very young age, this woman, their mother, turned her daughters against each other, and she fed them on $1 a day while she carried $30,000 in a bag around her waist. This woman seduced men and women in equal numbers, you know, often for nefarious purposes. She threatened to blackmail Gypsy later on, you know, for every dark and secret thing she'd done before making it big, including making references to that lost year and all the things that happened there. And this woman literally killed more than once to get her daughters on stage. So you can imagine the kind of household they grew up in and sort of their warped view of relationships. And they were always conditioned, you know, never to trust anyone but mother. And that included each other. And I do think that, you know, the girls wounded each other and inflicted wounds upon each other. And certainly Gypsy's idea of help wasn't always necessarily what June needed. There was a period after Vaudeville died when June was really struggling, just as Gypsy had struggled. And she's in marathon dancing, which was its own really surreal burlesque. You know, thousands of people would crowd into an arena and watch these teenagers dancing on their feet for months at a time and you know, going crazy and some of them actually going literally insane and few dying on the floor. I think June's record was standing for 2 months in a marathon dance. And so she goes to Gypsy, and the roles had reversed by this time. And Gypsy is the big star in New York at Minsky's Burlesque, and Gypsy is the one who is now famous, and not June. And so when June asks Gypsy for help, you know, Gypsy can't help but remember all of the perceived or real slights that went on between them as kids. And Gypsy offers to help her, and what she does is hook June up with some of the unsavory characters that she herself had associated with in the beginning. And I think part of Gypsy actually thought this was going to be helpful to June, and it would help June. It did help her, after all. But another part of her was sort of tone deaf and didn't realize, you know, maybe this is not the kindest thing to do to your sister. Maybe, you know, this is not the appropriate place to send somebody that you ostensibly care about. And I just think that might have been a function of Gypsy not really being able to love anyone except for the creation of Gypsy Rose Lee.
And which leads me to the question, what about her son, Eric? And I know that you spoke with him in preparing the book. Was he forthcoming about the family history? How did he feel about his grandmother?
Oh, he was. He told some really great stories. You know, of course, he had a really complicated relationship with his mother. As soon as he was able to hold the camera, she put him to work. So you can imagine this sort of unorthodox childhood. You know, you're undressing, you're taking photographs of your mother in all stages of dress and undress and going around the world with her and basically being an assistant as much as you're a son. So that was complicated in and of itself. And then, of course, Rose Hovick, his relationship with his grandmother, he didn't see her very often because at that point, Gypsy realized that, you know, her mother was not, it was not a good thing to have her mother constantly in her life at every moment. And she was trying to sort of extricate herself from the relationship a bit. But there's one great story in the book where she shows up at Gypsy's house on the Upper East Side of New York City, and Gypsy's upstairs getting ready. And Eric comes in and says, Mom, your mother's downstairs. And Gypsy says, well, for God's sake, Eric, go down there and watch her before she clips the Picasso. So Eric goes back down there, and Rose sits down on the couch and says, oh, you must be Eric. And she pulls a gun out of her purse and gives it to him. So, of course, Eric's a little boy here. She's about 6 years old, and he's delighted by this treasure. He goes up to show his mother, you know, that Grandma gave him a gun. And Gypsy, of course, confiscates this right away. But it was a message. It was a message to Gypsy, really referencing the one night in 1937 when a dead body surfaced at Gypsy's house and under Rose's, during one of Rose's parties. And it was sort of a message to Gypsy that those dark days weren't so far behind her.
Before we talk about the murders, Eric wasn't aware of his father's identity until age 18, and that was Otto Preminger. Did he ever have any kind of relationship with him?
He did, and that was one of the most telling scenes in the book, I think. You know, here Eric is thinking that his father was Alexander Kirkland, Gypsy's second husband, and once in a while suspecting it might have been Mike Todd, who was that big, brassy Chicago showman, and Gypsy's, I think if she was ever able to love a man, it would have been Mike Todd. But it was Otto Preminger, and Gypsy very calculatedly wanted to have Otto Preminger's child. She told June Havoc, you know, I'm going to find the meanest, smartest son of a bitch in the world. I'm going to have his child, and my child's going to rule the Earth. So that was her big proclamation. And when Eric wanted to know who his father was, you know, Gypsy's response was to light a cigarette and say, "None of your business."
Oh, well, okay, not sure that falls in with parenting today, but...
Yeah, well, she eventually relented and told him, but she just, I think she just was, you know, wasn't sure if Otto Preminger at that point wanted to be contacted, but he did, and they did forge a relationship.
Oh, okay, now back to the murders. It seems in the book that Rose was involved with three murders, a hotel manager, a hobo, and the young woman artist who lived on Rose's farm.
Yeah.
How much involvement and did Gypsy have or awareness in these murders?
I think that she was likely there for all three of them. She was most definitely there for the hotel manager. This was when they were in the Vaudeville Act. And in order to save money, you know, Rose Hovick was always wanting to save money. She crowded all of the kids, the boys, the girls, the entire Vaudeville Act into one hotel room. So, of course, this didn't please hotel managers, and one of them threatened to evict her. And in the musical, there's this scene where this is going on, and Rose cries rape in order to get rid of the hotel manager. But in reality, the story is that she pushed the manager fatally out the window and claimed it was self-defense. And I think Gypsy and June were there. The hobo, Gypsy, was definitely there. This is after June had left, Vaudeville had died, and mother and daughter were, you know, on the road together. This is during that desperate year, and to save money, they're camping out instead of staying at hotels. And just this poor sap happened to wander past the wrong tent at the wrong place. And with the third thing, the third murder of that young woman, you know, this is a period when 1937, when Gypsy's out in Los Angeles trying to forge a career as a movie star, and you know, really desperate to throw her attention onto that. And in order to get some distance from her mother, you know, she decides one of the ways to do that is to buy a country home in upstate New York and send her mother to live there. And so her mother goes there, and you know, Rose is always an enterprising woman, and she opens up a boarding house, and she boards lesbians and sort of makes an art colony for them where they feel safe and protected, and she sort of, you know, has them working for her on the farm there. Well, she's, you know, known for throwing some pretty wild parties, and the aftermath of one is that one of these boarders ends up with a bullet in her head.
Wow. You do such an incredible job of weaving the history of that time and place. Do you think that there'll be kind of like a TV special about all of this new information, or perhaps another film?
Oh, I would love, I mean, from your mouth to Hollywood ears, you know, one can only dream. But I understand that there's some sort of talk about a film in the works with Barbara Streisand slated to play Mama Rose.
No, I wonder if Barbara Streisand knows how evil the real Mama Rose was.
Yeah, she knows what she's getting into.
Right. Well, what's your next project?
My next project is Female Civil War Spies. It's the story of the Civil War as told through the perspectives of these four women, two who work for the Union and two who work for the Confederacy.
Oh, and when will that be out?
Hopefully in 2014.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much, Karen. It's a very gripping biography. I enjoyed reading it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
All righty. Bye.
Bye-bye.
America in the Roaring Twenties. Vaudeville is king. Talking pictures are only a distant flicker. Speakeasies beckon, money flows fast and free. But then, almost overnight, the Great Depression leveled everything. When the dust settled, Americans were primed for a star who could distract them from grim reality and excite them in new, unexpected ways. Enter Gypsy Rose Lee, a strutting, body erudite stripper who possessed a gift for delivering exactly what America needed. Karen Abbott in American Rose brings to life an era of ambition, glamour, struggle, and survival. Using exclusive interviews and never-before-published material, the author delves into Gypsy's world, including her intensely dramatic triangle relationship with her sister, actor June Havoc, and Mother Rose, a petite but ferocious woman who seduced men and women alike and literally killed to get her daughters on the stage. While I enjoyed learning about Gypsy's history, the book jumps around chronologically and was sometimes difficult to follow. Also, I wasn't enamored of Bernadette Dunn's narration, but you be the judge. Here is American Rose.
From Eric, I gathered that his mother was an array of complexities and contradictions, a madly self-assured woman who hid her nerves and insecurities an avid student of Freud, who disdained introspection. A fairly sad person and wounded soul, despite a desperate need to keep her heart close. An authority figure capable of inspiring awe and exasperation and loyalty and fury and love, often within the very same moment. June's memories are darker and more melancholy, which I attributed partly to the fact that she'd expected to die relatively young, just like her mother and sister before her. It is hard to fathom that the brave, brilliant girl she knew as Louise had been gone now for 40 years, nearly half of June's remarkably long and wonderfully rich life. I first met June in March 2008, exactly 2 years before she passed away, hoping she would guide me through Gypsy's mythology, peeling away the punchlines and fanciful digressions to reveal a core of truth. When I arrived at June's Connecticut farm, I found her lying in bed, her hair done up in pert white pigtails, a snack of Oreos and milk arranged on a side table. Her eyes were a bold shade of blue and painfully sensitive to light. She couldn't go more than a few moments without moaning and clenching them shut. She was 94 years old, give or take. Her mother, the infamous Madame Rose, was a prolific forger of birth certificates, and the legs that once danced on stages across the country were now motionless, two nearly imperceptible bumps tucked beneath crisp white sheets. She painted a deceptively frail picture. I learned soon enough, this wisp of a woman had retained her survivor's grit, her cannonball voice, her savvy instinct to question any stranger prying so deeply into the past. A part of me believed, all physical evidence to the contrary, that if so inclined, she could leap up and strangle me with quick and graceful hands. But she was welcoming and funny, lamenting a life steeped in Rumorsville, and genuinely appreciative of my gift, a video of her 4-year-old self performing in a 1918 silent film. She gave canned answers to certain queries, answers I'd heard or read elsewhere, that nevertheless seemed illuminating when delivered face to face by that deep and resonant voice. If her sister had shown any talent at all, she, June, would never have been born. Her vaudeville audience was like a big warm bath and the closest thing she had to family. Her mother was by turns tender and pathetic and terrifying, broken in a way that no one in that time or place had any idea how to fix. The musical Gypsy distorted her childhood so thoroughly it was as if I didn't own me anymore. The tone of her fan mail changed overnight, from sentiments of loving affection to, "What a little brat you must have been." June realized her sister was screwing me out in public, and that in the end, there was no stopping either Gypsy or Gypsy. The play was both her sister's monument and her best chance for monumental revisionism. It took another visit for June, just as private as Gypsy, to share bits of memory she'd never written about or pressed into a scrapbook, memories that defined her life even as they long lay dormant and unspoken. Money was Gypsy's god, and she would do anything to anybody, including June, to make more of it, and not just with regard to the musical. Gypsy did, in fact, do things not only to June but to herself. Terrible and awful and shocking things. Things beneath her sister's formidable intellect and keen wit. Things that made June believe, to that day, that love, even love fraught with competition and jealousy, never existed between them at all. I asked and listened for as much time as June gave me. I asked until her patience wore thin and her eyes watered with the effort to stay open. "I hope I didn't upset you today," I whispered, bending down to her ear. "That's not my intention." "I know," June said, though startling eyes found their focus settling on mine.
Despite all the headlines, what do we really know about the real Angelina Jolie? I picked this title to preview for two reasons. Brad and Angelina are Hollywood's current number one power couple. And the book, Angelina, An Unauthorized Biography, was written by biographer Andrew Morton, whose books forever changed the world's perception of Princess Di and Tom Cruise. Now film buffs can glimpse the inside story of the woman Forbes magazine has called the most powerful celebrity in the world. The daughter of actor John Voight, Angelina appeared in her first movie at the age of 7. She won an Oscar for Girl Interrupted, and who can forget that shocking kiss with her brother at the Academy Awards in 2000? Of late, the wild child with a heart and mind of her own, and the tattoos to show for it, has transformed herself into a UN Goodwill Ambassador, a renowned humanitarian, and a mother whose family just keeps on growing and growing. Bronson Pinchot narrates.
The Bertrand children were thrilled to be able to write to their friends back home that they lived on the same estate as Groucho Marx, Dean Martin, and Elvis Presley. Of course, no one in Riverdale believed them. Local legend has it that Debbie Bertrand even mailed her former school friend some loose change she had taken from the actor Don Adams, then the star of the TV hit Get Smart, to prove that she babysat for his children. Marsha Lynn's younger brother, Raleigh, quickly embraced the Hollywood lifestyle. For his 15th birthday, his parents, aware of his ambition to be a Formula One racing driver, gave him a red Ferrari sports car, even though he was too young to drive. That little inconvenience did not put the brakes on the young roustabout. When he went on a date with Gina Martin, a daughter of Dean Martin's, he asked his friend Peter Martini to take the wheel. He clearly enjoyed life in the fast lane. As his friend Randy Alpert, the son of jazz musician Herb Alpert, recalls, "Raleigh was a great guy and a good friend. We had a million fun times in Beverly Hills. Girls, cars, girls, cameras, wild turkey, girls, rainbow bar and grill, racing, girls, martini house, parties, and very often some girls. A far cry from life in Riverdale." In her own way, Marsha Lynn was at least as starry-eyed, if not more so, as the rest of her family. Like her mother, she avidly read the tabloids, soaking up the stories about the stars. There was a vicarious thrill about living in the midst of so many celebrities. Nevertheless, her exciting new life had its social costs. Marsha Lynn was careful to conceal her family's unglamorous origins from her classmates at Beverly Hills High School, talking vaguely about one day living in New York. Fellow student Adrian Neri remembers Marsha Lynn as quiet, inconspicuous, one of those artsy people on the edge of things. It didn't take long for Marsha Lynn to absorb the overarching dictum of life in Hollywood. You can be anyone you want to be. After graduating from Beverly Hills High in 1969, she joined the Lee Strasberg Theater and Film Institute and signed with the William Morris Agency to pursue modeling and acting work. She began to affect a more exotic persona, calling herself Marceline, which she explained was the way her French-Canadian grandmother, Marie-Louise Angelina, pronounced her name. Her family still called her Marsha. She took to drinking French vanilla instant coffee and collecting French crockery and other artifacts. Just to add an exotic frisson, the family believed that there was a dash of Iroquois Indian in the bloodline dating back to their French-Canadian settler roots. Certainly with her swooping dresses, embroidered headbands, and long hair, she was a poster child for the hippie generation. As she left her teenage years behind, something changed inside her. She later told a close friend, "There was a day after moving to Beverly Hills when I truly realized that I could actually marry someone famous." Marsha Lynn was born on May 9, 1950, to Lois and Roland Bertrand. Roland had just been named manager of his father-in-law's bowling alley in Riverdale, Illinois. Bowling was a heck of a business at the time, observes local historian Carl Dernovich. Everybody bowled. You couldn't get a lane sometimes. People either played baseball or they bowled. The nearby industrial town of Harvey was the largest manufacturing base in the country at the time. Jobs were plentiful, crime was unheard of, and everybody knew everyone else in the town of 4,000 people. The Riverdale where Lois was raised was straight out of a Norman Rockwell painting, complete with white picket fences and roses around the door. Dernovich compares it to the setting of the movie Pleasantville, the story of a saccharine-sweet small town where uncomfortable and unruly thoughts and ideas were shuffled under the sidewalk. Life in Riverdale was comfortable, secure, and recognizable, if a tad dull. Lois June Gowans dreamed of getting out, of becoming a star on the silver screen. The highlight of her week was when the glossy movie magazines arrived at the grocery store across the street from the tavern her parents owned. The moment the magazines were unloaded, she would dart to the grocery, reaching up to the rack on the front counter for the latest issue of Movie Mirror and Motion Picture. Then she would curl up in a chair in the family's apartment above the bar and pore over the photographs of Betty Grable, Rita Hayworth, Ginger Rogers, and other Hollywood stars of the day.
And speaking of Hollywood power couples, perhaps the most famous couple of all time, Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. He was a tough guy Welshman, softened by the affections of a breathtakingly beautiful woman. He was nominated for 7 Academy Awards, but never won one. She was a modern-day Cleopatra madly in love with her own Mark Antony. She won 2 Oscars, one for Butterfield 8 in 1960, and again for Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf in 1966. For nearly a quarter of a century, Taylor and Burton were Hollywood royalty. And in Furious Love, Elizabeth Taylor, Richard Burton, and the Marriage of the Century, you'll find a chronicle of their fiery romance, the most notorious, publicized, and celebrated love affair of its day. For the first time, Vanity Fair contributing editor Sam Kashner and acclaimed biographer Nancy Schoenberger tell the complete story of this larger-than-life couple, showing how their romance and 2 marriages commanded the attention of the world. And for the first time in exclusive access given to the authors, Elizabeth Taylor gives never-revealed details and firsthand accounts of her life with Burton. Drawing upon this new information and on Burton's private, passionate, and heartbreaking letters to Taylor, Furious Love sheds new light on the movies, the sex, the scandals, the fame, the brawls, the booze, the separations, and of course, the fabled jewels. It offers an intimate glimpse into Elizabeth and Richard's privileged world and their elite circle of friends, who included Princess Grace, Montgomery Clift, the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, Peter O'Toole, Michael Caine, Brando, Olivier, the Kennedys, and Aristotle Onassis. Their epic story, narrated by Paul Bomer, provides an eye-opening look at their films, their wildly lucrative reign in Europe and in Hollywood, and the price they paid for their extravagant lives.
When asked by Time magazine a few years ago to name the 5 great love affairs of all time, the Texas-born gossip columnist Liz Smith didn't even have to think about who would occupy first place. The Burtons, of course. Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor were the most vivid example of a public love affair that I can think of. The Burtons and the Lindbergh baby being kidnapped and Kennedy's assassination. These are the biggest stories of our time. Whenever somebody says, so-and-so is a big star, I say, have they been condemned by the Vatican? Their 13-year saga was the most notorious, publicized, celebrated, and vilified love affair of its day. Indeed, their 10-year marriage, followed by a divorce, remarriage, and a final divorce, was often called the marriage of the century in the press. Just 30 years earlier, the Duke of Windsor had embarked upon his own famous marriage to Wallis Simpson, giving up the throne of England to marry the American divorcee from Baltimore. A nation wept, but the Duke and Duchess of Windsor went on to rule a shadow empire of jet-setters, aristocrats, gigolos, international bon vivants, in a floating world of yachts, dance floors, casinos, and the homes and hotels of the very rich. So famous were the Burtons in the 1960s and 1970s that the Duke and the Duchess were their only peers, the only other couple who knew what it was like to be pariahs for a time, to pay a high price for their choices, and to live the rest of their lives in isolated luxury. But the notorious Burtons managed to win their way back into the hearts of the American public through sheer talent, hard work, chutzpah, and glamour. On the face of it, said columnist Smith, Elizabeth Taylor was just totally arrogant. She'd walk out in capri pants and her Cleopatra makeup and her kerchief and go off to whatever local restaurant and drink up a storm with Burton. That's part of what excited the public. Her vulgarity and her arrogance and the money. Oh, God, their love story had everything. It also brought us the modern accoutrements of celebrity, the relentless paparazzi, the continuous press exposure, the public airing of private grief. In short, it brought us Liz and Dick, a tabloid shorthand that they hated, but that stood for everything extravagant and over the top about their all too public lives. In fact, you might say there were two marriages, the ballyhooed union of Liz and Dick, and the private marriage of Richard and Elizabeth. More often than not, Liz and Dick overwhelmed the private marriage, holding it hostage and ultimately helping to destroy it. The yachts, the glamorous ports of call, Monte Carlo, Portofino, the grand hotels of the world, the fabled jewels, the homes in London, Kestadt, Seligny, and Puerto Vallarta, the hobnobbing with the Rothschilds, Arionassis, General Tito of Yugoslavia, and, of course, the Windsors. They were indeed Hollywood royalty. But like any other married couple, they had to deal with children coming of age during the cultural upheavals of the 1960s, communes, family squabbles, balancing two careers, even if their careers meant making some of the most remarkable films of the 1960s. In short, the real marriage of two people trying to live their lives together.
For 60 years, since the birth of United Artists, the studio landscape had been virtually unchanged. Then came director Steven Spielberg, next billionaire David Geffen, and finally Jeffrey Katzenberg, and voila, an entertainment empire called DreamWorks. Now, Nicole Laporte, who covered the company for Variety, goes behind the hype in The Men Who Would Be King, an almost epic tale of moguls, movies, and a company called DreamWorks. Readers get a look into the creative calamities of movie making as Laporte's fly-on-the-wall detail shows us Hollywood's bizarre rules of business. We see the clashes between Spielberg's troops and Katzenberg warriors, the debacles and disasters, but also the Oscar-winning triumphs, including Saving Private Ryan. We watch as the studio burns through billions, its rich owners get richer, and everybody else suffers. We see Geffen seducing investors like Microsoft's Paul Allen, showing his steel against CAA's Michael Ovitz, and staging fireworks during negotiations with Paramount and Disney. Here is Hollywood, up close, glamorous, and gritty. The book is read by Stephen Hoy.
But as the DreamWorks story turned out to be much less than its founders envisioned, all that hype took its toll. By setting the expectations so high on so many levels, the plan was to be a sprawling multimedia venture that made better product, movies, TV shows, music, than the rest of Hollywood. It was all but impossible to live up to its promise. Tom Hanks once joked that the inevitable reaction to DreamWorks' first film, given who was behind it, would be, "Is that it?" By the time DreamWorks' live-action studio was sold to Paramount in 2005, the same question could be asked of the entire studio. There was certainly an inspiring nobility in DreamWorks' desire to rewrite the rules. The company's stated mission was to put art first. It was proclaimed the new United Artists, the prototypical inmates running the Asylum Studio formed in 1919 by Douglas Fairbanks, Mary Pickford, Charlie Chaplin, and D.W. Griffith. But too often the attempt to do more, do better, smacked of hubris and egos that had long ago lost touch with reality as mere mortals know it. the power that Spielberg, Katzenberg, and Geffen wield in Hollywood, and their effective demonstrations of it, breeds extreme fear and trembling in a town that thrives on hyperbole and drama. There's a very strong fear element, confided one insider, who has a long history with DreamWorks. Both Geffen and Katzenberg are known to have long memories when it comes to keeping score, and when an enemy is declared, the war is no mere skirmish. Years before, one-time super agent Michael Ovitz was toppled from his perch atop the Creative Artists Agency, Geffen told friends he was going to destroy Ovitz, with whom he had a tempestuous past. "Watch me," he said. Ovitz undoubtedly had a hand in his own fall, but Geffen fueled the process, trashing Ovitz for years, and creating the perception that he was very damaged goods. The result of these effective theatrics was estimable. As Ovitz loved to say of Hollywood, perception is everything. Similarly, when Geffen turned on Bill and Hillary Clinton after years of serving as the former president's biggest Hollywood donor and champion, it was not pretty. Or private. Everybody in politics lies, but they do it with such ease it's troubling, Geffen told New York Times op-ed columnist Maureen Dowd, whose column was considered, at least where Hollywood contributions were concerned, a watershed moment in the 2008 race for the Democratic presidential nomination, turning things in Barack Obama's favor. Dowd neglected to question her sources' own credentials as an arbiter of integrity, not to mention that some speculated that should Geffen buy the Los Angeles Times, a possibility at the time, she would be one of his first hires. Few people in Hollywood are willing to cross these men, for fear of risking a premature close to a career or some other form of revenge. At one point during my tenure at Variety, where I covered the company, DreamWorks felt I was asking too many informed questions, thanks to a certain source whom I regularly called for briefings. Through a semi-elaborate baiting system, referred to within DreamWorks by some as a massive sting, the chatty source was identified and blackballed by the studio. DreamWorks employees who divulged too much were met with similar treatment. One former executive confided that when too many stories about the company started showing up in the press, Geffen addressed the staff, laying down threats. "I've got phone records," he said. "I'll go through them and find out who's talking. We'll get you." Granted, talking to the press is verboten at most Hollywood studios, but at DreamWorks, the fact that it is David Geffen making threats makes it more chilling. Katzenberg made dozens of calls, warning sources not to talk to me for this book, a reality that made telling the DreamWorks story a delicate, difficult process. At times I wondered who was working harder to make contact with people, Katzenberg or myself. As a result, many of the more than 200 people I interviewed only felt comfortable under the veil of anonymity, and even they were anxious. I got used to nervous glances toward restaurant entrances, quick exits. My attempts to change the minds of the DreamWorks partners about being interviewed were futile.
Though she never won an Oscar, she was a superstar. Marilyn Monroe's image is so universal, we can't help but believe that we know all there is to know about her. Her every word and gesture made headlines and garnered controversy. Her talent as an actor was oftentimes eclipsed by her notoriety. But what of the other Marilyn? Fragments, poems, intimate notes, and letters by Stanley Buchtall and Bernard Comment goes beyond the headlines to find a woman far more curious, searching, and hopeful than the one the world got to know. Even as the Hollywood studios tried to mold and suppress her, Marilyn never lost her insight, her passion, and her humor. In this book, we meet the private Marilyn. Fragments is an unprecedented collection of artifacts, notes to herself, letters, even poems. These bits of text, jotted in notebooks, typed on paper, or written on hotel letterhead, reveals a woman who loved deeply and strove to perfect her craft. They show a Marilyn Monroe unsparing in her analysis of her own life, but also playful, funny, and impossibly charming. The easy grace and deceptive lightness that made her performances so memorable emerge here, as does the simmering tragedy that made her last appearances so heartbreaking. The book is narrated by Isabel Keating.
Other record notebook, around 1955. It is likely that this group of notes, which is coherent and forms a certain continuity, dates from the time Marilyn started working with Lee Strasberg, around 1955. A sincere effort at introspection can be observed as the star returned to her childhood and the lifelong fears it engendered. Aunt Ida is probably Ida Martin, rather than Ida Bollander, with whom Marilyn also stayed as a child. Ida Martin was the mother of Marilyn's aunt by marriage, an evangelical Christian and strict disciplinarian who emphasized obedience and was repressive about sexual issues in general. She may also have made the 12-year-old Norma Jean feel guilty for an episode in which she said she had been molested. To no longer feel ashamed of what you were, of what you desired. This was what Marilyn, who had made her childhood dream come true by becoming an actress, was now aiming for. We may also assume that she had just started psychoanalysis, as she pointed out the bent of the unconscious to forget and repress, an impulse she urged herself to struggle against by trying to reclaim memory in order to be able to accept herself fully. She experienced work as a way of freeing herself from the constraints and shackles of the past, and these pages can be read as an outline of self-analysis, both gripping and moving.
Life starts from now. Ida, I have still been obeying her. It's not only harmful for me to do so, but unreality, because life starts from now. Inhibits myself, inhibits my work, inhibits thoughts. In my work, I don't want to obey her any longer, and I can do my work as fully as I wish, since as a small child, intact, first desire was to be an actress, and I spent years play-acting until I had jobs. I will not be punished, or trying to hide it, enjoying myself as fully as I wish or want to. I will be as sensitive as I am without being ashamed of it. Trust in the faith, in the simple objects and tasks, sense memory, outside and inside objects. I haven't had faith in life, meaning reality. Whatever it is or happens, there is nothing to hold on to but reality, to realize the present, whatever it may be, because that's how it is. And it's much better to know reality or things as they are than not to know and to have few illusions as possible. Train my will now. Working, doing my tasks that I have set for myself on the stage, I will not be punished for it, or be whipped, or be threatened, or not be loved, or sent to hell to burn with bad people, feeling that I am also bad, or be afraid of my genitals being... or ashamed, exposed, known, and seen. So what? Or ashamed of my sensitive feelings? They are reality, or colors, or screaming.
Who do I think I am? Guess I don't. Readers, Hollywood never fails to entertain, and neither does the world of books. Thanks so much for joining us this week. Be sure to keep up to date with the show's website at www.bookreportradio.com. And drop me a line with any suggestions for titles or comments you may have, Elaine@bookreportradio.com. See you back here next week for the next chapter of The Book Report. Bring it to